Good evening, everybody. My name is Suzanne Youngerman, and I'm director of the Department of Education and Humanities here at BAM that helps put together these wonderful evenings. And it's my great pleasure to welcome you to tonight's program on behalf of Karen Brooks Hopkins, president of BAM, Joseph Melillo, executive producer of BAM, and all of us at BAM are so pleased to see you here tonight for this wonderful program. We're delighted to be able to thank our valued sponsors, some of whom are with us tonight. BAM's programs are only made possible through their generous support. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce our partner, Harold Elgenbaum, Executive Director of the National Book Foundation, their partner in the Seek, Drink, and Be Literary series, and he will tell you more about tonight's program. Thank you.
Good evening. Welcome on behalf of the National Book Foundation. Let me talk about what's going to go on this evening. First, I'm going to introduce our moderator this evening. She will then introduce our guest speaker. Then our guest speaker, Peter Carey, will come up and do a reading. The technical people here will take the lectern off. They'll set it up. Even and Peter will have a conversation, and then we're going to open it up to the audience for questions. Afterwards, there'll be a signing in front of the bookstore. Now, the reason I wanted to bring up Sholem Auslander. For those of you who were here when Andre Aciman was here, when I interviewed Andre Aciman, probably noted that it seemed like it was a lot of fun to be up here to do these interviews. And it was, and it is. So I'm looking forward to doing Sholem Auslander. But I do also want to say, because tonight is the last night that Even Sweeney is going to be here. She's done three of these. This is her fourth one. She wasn't available for the whole series, but this is her last one. And the reason I wanted to mention that is because, apart from her being a friend of mine, someone I love dearly, is that I think she's done an absolutely fabulous job with these interviews. And she's taken them very seriously, and she has, you know, really taken them to a different level. So if she looks like she's enjoying herself, if I look like I'm enjoying myself, we are. Now, I guess the only thing left is that you enjoy yourselves. So we hope you do. Even Sweeney studied at Harvard University, where she won the John Harvard Scholarship and the Elizabeth Carey Agassiz Award. She has an MFA from the University of Virginia, where she studied with Deborah Eisenberg, and she writes book reviews for major publications across the country. She's also the director of the Center for the Humanities at the CUNY Graduate Center in Midtown. She published her first novel, a wonderful novel, in July called, among other things, I've Taken Up Smoking. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome, unfortunately, for the last time this year, Even Sweeney.
Hi, thank you so much. I want to thank Harold again for giving me such a great gig. This has really been fun, and it's been a huge pleasure just to hang out with him and also to meet the folks at BAM, Karen Brooks Hopkins, Eleanor, Suzanne Youngerman, as well as Amber Rooney, as well as all of you, the audience, who have obviously made my job very easy. As soon as my little part of it is over, I look forward to your questions, which are always really good. And so that's been a really wonderful thing. BAM, as you know, has had a huge impact on Brooklyn, and it's really been fun to be a part of the work it's doing and a kind of privilege to watch it as it grows and changes, our lovely Brooklyn. I'm frankly a little overwhelmed to be introducing Peter Carey tonight, who is, quite simply, I think one of the best novelists of our time. I assume some of you may be wondering, as I've occasionally wondered myself, if he is in fact a human being. For one thing, no one wins the Booker Prize twice. For two, he has written 11 novels and a bunch of other stuff. And for three, all of this work is spectacularly good. One might easily suspect that he had three heads, all of which were really brainy and writerly. Or that, in fact, he came to us from another century where there was no TV and novels got the respect they deserved. Of course, eating dinner with him is a good way to remind yourself that he is indeed a human being. And, in fact, the best way to actually really remember that he's, in fact, a human being is to read his books. His work is wildly imaginative and wickedly clever, but it is also always, I find anyway, startlingly human. His novels, which in their titles announce his playful obsession with artistry and fraud, and which bring to life an impossible range of voices from various continents and cultures and classes, always also, I think, very wisely remind us of our own limitations. His characters are fighters and failures, battlers, as he calls them, who refuse to be unbelievable. And his language, I think, in his language, I think you find that same fresh juxtaposition, the kind of pairing of gorgeous, mind-leaping metaphor with concrete detail and a mix of kind of intellectual prank with a kind of raw physicality and an unrelenting narrative momentum. The list of prizes he's won for this miraculous chemistry is really too long to read out loud here, so I'm just going to read the titles of his novels to give you a sense of them. You're probably familiar, but they go like this: Bliss, Illy Whacker, Oscar and Lucinda, The Tax Inspector, The Unusual Life of Tristan Smith, Jack Mags, True History of the Kelly Gang, My Life is a Fake, Theft, A Love Story, and finally, His Illegal Self, which we have the privilege to hear him reading from tonight. So please welcome Peter Carey.
Well, this is the part of the reading where the writer is meant to talk a little bit and convince the audience that, freakish as he is, he's also human and sort of quite likable and all that sort of thing. But unfortunately, all I can really do is sort of scratch a little bit of hummus with my shirt. And that'll have to do, because I'm reading from the beginning of my novel and there isn't an awful lot to set up. So I guess all my human fallibility will have to really wait till I'm interrogated after the reading. So, here we are. Product shot. Maybe I should say all this stuff again. It's called His Illegal Self. And the first thing I'll say is, one. There were no photographs of the boy's father in the house upstate. He had been persona non grata since Christmas 1964, six months before the boy was born. There were plenty of pictures of his mum. There she was with short blonde hair, her eyes so white against her tan, and that was her also with black hair, not even a sister to the blonde girl, although maybe they shared a kind of bright attention. She was an actress, like her grandma, it was said. She could change herself into anyone. The boy had no reason to disbelieve this, not having seen his mother since the age of two. She was the prodigal daughter, the damaged saint, like the icon that Grandpa once brought back from Athens, shining silver, musky incense, although no one ever told the boy how his mother smelled. Then, when the boy was almost eight, a woman stepped out of the elevator into the apartment on East 62nd Street, and he recognized her straight away. No one had told him to expect it. And that was pretty typical of growing up with Grandma Selkirk. You were some kind of lovely insect, expected to know things through your feelers, by the kaleidoscope patterns in the other's eyes. No one would dream of saying, "Here is your mother, return to you." Instead, his grandma told him to put on his sweater. She collected her purse, found her keys, and then all three of them walked down to Bloomingdale's, as if it were a deli. This was normal life. Across park, down Lex, the boy stood close beside the splendid stranger with the lumpy khaki pack strapped onto her back. That was her blood. He could hear it now, pounding in his ears. He had imagined her a wound-up spring, light, bright, blonde, like Grandma in full whir. She was completely different. She was just the same. By the time they were in Bloomingdale, she was arguing about his name. "What did you just call Che?" she asked the grandma. "His name," replied Grandma Selkirk, ruffling the boy's darkening summer hair. "That's what I called him." And she gave the mother a bright, white smile, and the boy thought, uh-uh. It sounded like Jay, the mother said. The grandma turned sharply to the shop girl who was busy staring at the hippie mother. Let me try the Artemis, she said. Grandma Selkirk was what they call an Upper East Side woman. Cheekbones, tailored grey hair. But that was not what she called herself. I am the last bohemian, she liked to say, to the boy particularly, meaning that no one told her what to do, at least not since Pa Selkirk had thrown the Buddha out the window and gone to live with the poisoned dwarf. Grandpa had done a whole heap of other things besides, like giving up his board seat, like going spiritual. When Grandpa moved out, Grandma moved out too. The Park Avenue apartment was hers, always had been, but now they used it maybe once a month. Instead, they spent their time on Kenosha Lake near Jeffersonville, New York, a town of 400 where no one lived. Grandma made raku pots and rowed a heavy clinker boat. The boy hardly saw his grandpa after that, except sometimes there were postcards with very small handwriting. Buster Selkirk could fit a whole ball game on a single card. For these last 5 years, it had been just Grandma and the boy together, and she threaded the squirming live bait to hook the largemouthed bass and also called him Jay instead of Che. There were no kids to play with, there were no pets because Grandma was allergic, but in fall, there were Cox's pippins, wild storms, bare feet, warm mud, and the crushed glass stars spilling across the cooling sky. You can't learn these things anywhere, the grandma said. She said she planned to bring him up Victorian. It was better than all this. He was christened Che, right? Grandma's wrist was pale and smooth as a flounder's belly. The sunny side of her arm was brown, but she dabbed the perfume on the white side, blue blood. That's what he thought, looking at the veins. Christened? His father is a Jew, the grandma said. This fragrance is too old for us, she told the Bloomingdale's woman, who raised a cautious eyebrow at the mother. The mother shrugged as if to say, what are you going to do? Too floral, Grandma Selkirk said. Without doubting, she would know. So it's Jay. Grandma spun around and the boy's stomach gave a squishy sort of lurch. Why are you arguing with me? She whispered. Are you emotionally tone deaf? The sales girl pursed her lips in violent sympathy. Give me the Chanel, said Grandma Selkirk. While the sales girl wrapped the perfume, Grandma Selkirk wrote a check. Then she took her pale kid gloves from the glass countertop. The boy watched as she drew them onto each finger, thick as eel skin. He could taste it in his mouth. You want me to call him Che in Bloomingdale's? His grandma hissed, finally presenting the gift to the mother. Shh, the mother said. The grandma raised her eyebrows violently. Go with the flow, said the mother. The boy petted her on the hip and found her soft, uncorseted. The flow? The grandma had a bright, fright smile and angry, light blue eyes. Go with the flow? Thank you, the girl said, for shopping at Bloomingdale's. The grandma's attention was all on the mother. Is that what communists believe? Che, she cried, waving her gloved hand as in charades. I'm not a communist, okay? The boy wanted only peace. He followed up behind, his stomach churning. Che, Che, go with the flow. Look at you. Do you think you could make yourself a tiny bit more ridiculous? The boy considered his illegal mother. He knew who she was, although no one would say it outright. He knew her the way he was used to knowing everything important, from hints and whispers, by hearing someone talking on the phone, although this particular event was so much clearer, had been since the minute she blew into the apartment, the way she held him in her arms and squeezed the air from him and kissed his neck. He had thought of her so many nights, and here she was, exactly the same, completely different, honey-coloured skin and tangled hair in 15 shades. She had Hindu necklaces, little silver bells around her ankles, an angel sent by God. Grandma Selkirk plucked at the Hindu beads. What is this? This is what the working class is wearing now? I am the working class, she said, by definition. The boy squeezed the grandma's hand, but she snatched it free. Where's his father? She said. They keep showing his face on television. Is he going with the flow as well? The boy burped quietly in his hand. No one could have heard him, but Grandma brushed at the air as if grabbing at a fly. I called him Jay because I was worried for you, she said at last. Maybe it should have been John Doe. God help me, she cried, and the crowds parted before her. Now I understand I was an idiot to worry. The mother raised her eyebrows at the boy and finally reached to take his hand. He was pleased by how it folded around his, soothing, comfortable. She tickled his palm in secret. He smiled up, she smiled down. All around them, Grandma raged. For this we paid for Harvard? Some Rosenbergs? The boy was deaf in love. By now they were out on Lexington Avenue and his grandma was looking for a taxi. The first cab would be theirs, always was, except that now his hand was inside his true mother's hand and they were marsupials running down into the subway laughing. In Bloomingdale's everything had been so white and bright with glistening brass. Now they raced down the steps. He could have flown. At the turnstile she released his hand and pushed him under. She slipped off her pack. He was giddy, giggling. She was laughing too. They had entered another planet. And as they pushed down to the platform, the ceiling was slimed with alien rust, and the floor was flecked and speckled with black gum. So this was the real world that had been crying to him from beneath the grating up on Lex. They ran together to the local, and his heart was pounding, and his stomach was filled with bubbles like an ice cream float. She took his hand once more and kissed it, stumbling. The train carried him through the dark, wire skeins unravelling, his entire life changing all at once. He burped again. The cars swayed and screeched, thick teams of brutal cables showing in the windowed dark. And then he was in Grand Central, first time ever, and they set off underground again, hand in hand, slippery together as newborn goats. Men lived in cardboard boxes. A blind boy rattled dimes and quarters in a tin. The shuttle waited, painted like a warrior, and they jumped together, and the doors closed as cruel as traps. Chop, 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 and his face was pushed against his mother's jasmine dress. Her hand held the back of his head. He was underground, as Cameron in 5D had predicted. They will come for you, man. They'll break you out of here. So now I'm going to skip a whole lot of really good pages. And I'm sorry about that. But I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because where we're going to find ourselves in a second is in Australia, because this pair has ended up being on the run. And Cameron, the boy downstairs who's really been Che's informant and political lecturer, Cameron being all of about 16, will provide the link in the story for us here. But Cameron could not imagine the boy hitchhiking in this world beyond the Clorox stairs, the foreign sky bruised like cheekbones, heavy rain streaming in a distant fringe. A spooky yellow light shone on the highway, and there was a fine, hot clay dust, dry on the boy's toes, mud on his now homeless tongue, powder on the needles of Pinus radiata plantations. It was 100 degrees Fahrenheit, more or less. They kept on walking. Two black lanes north, two lanes south, some foreign grass in the middle. To the east and west were neatly mown verges about 30 feet wide, and then there were the dull green walls of the Pinus radiata plantations, sliced by yellow fire roads, but deathly quiet. Not a possum or a snake, not even a hopping carrion crow could ever live there. The boy had no idea where on earth he stood. He understood the names of hardly anything, himself included. In this entire continent, he knew only the big-faced, big-boned mother with her bag full of entertainments. She was two long strides ahead, long, long hippie skirt, T-shirt, rubber flip-flops, walking way too fast. What he really knew about her, He could have written on a candy wrapper. She was a radical. But that was as obvious as the exit sign ahead. The boy spelled out the sign. Caboolture. A town, she said. It's nothing. She would not slow down. What sort of town? His strong hair was disguised, dyed black, cut like a hedge, revealing a band of pale, untanned skin around his neck. He rubbed at the crown and squinted up at the sign. Caboolture. Dumb black letters on a dumb white board. An ugly redneck sort of thing, he thought. What sort of town, Dial? Come on, she said. It's an Australian town. He should have asked other stuff like, where is my father, where is my grandma, but sometimes it seemed she was sick of him already. Moron, she shouted at the passing car. I hope you drown. She was so tall, so pretty, with a big farm boy's stride. His cup of tea, his flesh and blood forever. No one's going to pick us up here, Dial. They're all going the other way. Thanks, she said. I hadn't noticed. She was not used to little kids. The cars on the southbound road were bumper to bumper, the yellow headlights glowing the colour of the Pan Am building at dusk. It was sometime around noon. He wished she could find a place to curl up with jet lag. We could go to that town, he said, or words like that. Maybe there's a motel. And that's what he liked the most, just to be with her, cuddling while she read to him, her hair tickling his face. There's no motel, the mother said. I bet there is. She stopped and turned. What? He demanded. What? Her hair had so many shifting tones. You could never say exactly what it was, but her eyebrows were plain black, and when she pressed down, they pressed down on her eyes like this, like now, she was a scary witch. Okay, she said, that's enough. She'd done this once before in Port Authority, and she'd scared him then as well. Around this time, a beat-up 1964 Ford station wagon, its paintwork gone powdery with sun and age, paused at the exit of the Golden Fleece service station on the Brisbane side of Caboolture. The driver revved the engine once, and a flood of oil-blue smoke spread slowly across the pump island and dispersed into the scrubby field where two itchy-looking horses stood, their bony haunches directed at the fleeing cars. Now, you have to take my word for it that there are two really important people in that car. And one of them is a person, I mean, it's 1972. We just call him a hippie, I suppose. If you looked at it from the perspective of 2008, you might call him a survivalist, but a sort of a libertarian survivalist of some sort. Anyway, he's a hippie, and he lives at the top of a hill, and he's somebody that when you meet him, I don't think you're going to like him too much. But it's my job to change your mind about that. So this is the first time that the pair of them actually go up the hill to visit Trevor. And there's not a whole lot of story in this reading. It's just a little bit of landscape and some sense of the boy's situation, I suppose. The road to Trevor Dobbs's hideout was like he had bragged to the boy already. Outlaw, very steep, rutted, washed away potholes, tank traps, killer rocks, one stained black with oil, the death of an auto owned by someone who had no business. It was on a road that didn't want you any more than you wanted it. On the high side of the cutting there was wild bush, but no shade at that hour, and the dirt was baked hard and comfortless. There were no threats or skulls or crossbones nailed to tree trunks. But at one place there was an abandoned Volvo in a tree. It seemed to have slid down the hill and then skidded backward into space, and there it had come to stop with its back wheels stuck in a burned old wattle. The front wheels had slipped clear off the edge of the road, and it clung to the yellow clay road with just inches to spare. Beneath it was nothing but giddiness. The Volvo had gotten burned at the time of the accident, or later, you couldn't tell. It was black from fire and brown from rust and thin as cigarette paper, like a eaten wasp abandoned in a web. As the boy and the mother approached, he heard a rustling sound in its dark throat, then loud flapping or slapping. The boy's hair was too heavy to stand upright, but it pulled at his scalp and filled his neck with fright. Then a huge black bird, a vulture, he thought, but a bush turkey, actually, flew out the front window, leaving the shell of rust to rock and sway like a dead flower on a brittle black stem. The boy's heart was in his ears. His legs were aching. He asked, "How will he know where to find me?" "Who, baby?" "My daddy," he said, his throat stinging. Dial squatted down before him, her two big eyes watching him as though he were a mouse in a glue trap, something she did not know how to kill. "Have you been thinking about your daddy?" What did she think, he thought, forever, through the sweaty nights and burning days? "Oh, baby," she said, and reached out to hug him. He tugged away and walked on up the hill, feeling the biting gravel sneaking in between his feet and rubber thongs. Every day his skin got hurt or broken. "Che, talk to me. I'm Jay," he said. He did not have many ways to hurt her. "Jay will tell your daddy where you are." He feared that was a lie, but at the same time he hoped it wasn't. "How?" "I'll write a letter." He was maybe 10 feet farther up the hill now, looking down at her at last. "When?" "Tonight," she said. "Do you love my daddy?" he asked. She lifted her big, scratched hands up to her breast. He understood, or thought he did, but he turned and continued up the hill and did not look at her misery until they arrived finally on a wide saddle where it seemed the road had led to nothing more than 5 big drums of diesel fuel. "Where now?" he demanded. Well, the answer to that is page 148. And that's really the end of the reading. There's lots of funny stuff in this too, guys. So, thank you.
Thank you so much. That was really great. I'm sure you guys would all agree. I think when I first read that book, I thought you were actually going to launch into a book which took place in America. And then it got to Australia. Did you know you were going to get to Australia, or did you even know that you were starting out? I mean, did you know you were going to start in America? Or how did...
You don't know how hard I tried to avoid having to write American characters. You know, I mean, I've lived here 18 years. I've got a 17-year-old who was born at Beth Israel. But there is still the sense that maybe some people in the audience will recognize the sense of being, you know, not from here. And I've got lots of American writer friends who write deeply from here. But the place I started was actually something that happened years and years ago in Australia when I was sort of living with hippies after a fashion, in a complicated way. But when an American guy arrived, who later turned out when the helicopters arrived to take him home, to have been wanted by the FBI for a conspiracy to import cocaine from Mexico into the United States. But that's not... And I certainly didn't want to... But the thing that always interests me about that particular incident, with everybody scrambling through the bush at 6 a.m. saying, "Hide your stuff," when the helicopters were there, was that our American friend really didn't know where he was. And in fact, we welcomed him like everybody welcomed everybody. And he started to fix up an old hut. But in the first week, we saw him there, and he was planting dope plants in his driveway. And what he didn't... It was very clear at that moment he had no idea where on earth he was, because he'd just arrived in Queensland in 1970, which was, you know, a really nasty, corrupt police state with... was a really bad place to be living in a hippie community, and we were harassed all the time. But the thing that I thought, he thinks he's come to the edge of the earth, and he hasn't. And then a lot of comic things happened after that. But that's what stayed in my mind. But I didn't want to write about a drug smuggler. And so I just started to think about 1970 and people being on the run for other reasons. Mm-hmm. And I started with this moment with a pair of them walking along this highway, this woman and this little boy.
You've talked a lot about being a colonial and sort of inventing your own country and that being part of the project of your work. Mm-hmm. Do you think that writing from an American perspective... Does that represent a kind of turning point in your rethinking Australia? Or
I don't know. I mean, I've just been in Australia and at the Adelaide Festival, and what can I say? My people. The degree to which Australian readers occasionally very upset about the notion that I should even imagine things from an American point of view is very interesting. I did a reading with Paul Osterhoff, Siri Husvedt, and Ian McEwan, all my friends, at the town hall in Adelaide. And it was that sort of embarrassing thing when you bring your friends home to meet the family. And so we did this thing. And so after I'd read exactly this, there's a voice up the back that says, why did you go to live in New York? And why do I notice the use of American idiom in this thing you have read where you say float and not spider as we do? So this went on a little bit. So then you have to sort of start to talk in answering that question. The first answer, the first, of course, is none of your business. But the rest of it is more interesting. And it is to do with colonialism and the... A lot of Americans often go to Australia and feel the great similarities. There are huge differences, and one of them is that we didn't have a war of independence, and we the great marking moment of our foundation is really with these people who have been cast out. I think we carry huge, huge psychic wounds. The business of writing about my country, I realise, almost always involves another country. Mm-hmm. Which is rather peculiar. And so the notion of having American characters and Australia seen through American eyes was quite a disturbing effect on Australian readers. I generally like it, but occasionally it upsets them. I suppose I've not really answered that question directly. But the past has not gone away. We like to think it has. We like to think we're cool and the past never happened and that it didn't affect us. And we were once sort of very... unsure of ourselves and vulnerable and asking people the minute they got off the aeroplane how they liked our country. Things don't change so fast, I guess. And so this question about Americans in Australia has all sorts of political and social vibrations there.
Yeah. But by the time you got to the end of this book, did you feel like you had some kind of... You go all the way through this book with an American perspective on Australia. Yeah. Did you feel like that changed... Well, no, because you couldn't.
I mean, I think the thing is, it's not. I don't necessarily come out of a book any smarter about anything. I mean, I've just sort of made the book work in a way. So I didn't. The end was sort of approximately where I wanted to get to, and where I wanted to get to really, I suppose, wasn't primarily about Australia and America, but it was about this little boy. Who is going to grow to be a man who has at this moment in time been absolutely, completely loved, and that moment will exist within this unexpected person who's you would never think would carry this history forever. That's one of the things I was trying to do anyway.
Yeah, that's a really beautifully put way to think about the book, actually. I think another thing that I loved about this book is the kind of underlying lie in it that we promise not to break open, although it does break open only 20 or so pages after he stopped tonight. But we're not going to tell you what it is. But I did kind of want to talk about this kind of trope or refrain of lying and deceit that's in your work.
Human.
You are indeed human.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'm wondering if you ever do feel like you're sort of tricking your reader.
Oh, no. Oh, well, no, yes. I think there's some sort of pact that you make with the reader that you really have to honour. I mean, about who you are, what you're doing, what the name of the game generally is. And I think that's really... It's why we get so mad when we think that... someone's lied to us, that they've said something is, you know, about their life and it turns out not to be about their life, and we get angry and tricked and we wonder why that is, and some people say, well, it doesn't matter, it's a good book. But there's a pact between the writer and the reader that's been broken. And then after that, of course, trick all the time. I mean, we read surely to be surprised. We really read so that, you know, what happens in the next word and the next sentence and the next page is new to us, and we go around a bend and there's a new aspect that we didn't expect, and that involves holding stuff back and concealing things, and that's a sort of a form of trickery, but it's a sort of a It's a very honest trickery, and it's, you know, why one pays the money to go to the magic show or whatever it is that one's doing. So, yes, and the thing that we're talking about, I mean, there's a really big thing in this book, which
we don't
want to talk about. And it's about the nature of a relationship. And almost every reviewer in the world, I've spent 2 years writing this damn thing, and so every reviewer in the world thinks, oh, well, I'll tell everybody. Oh, well, fuck you, really, excuse me. You know, it's terrible that people think that they have to do this thing and they're somehow doing the reader a favour by doing it. And there is a sort of a confusion, I think, in many minds that somehow or other, if you tell a story, you've represented the work of art. But, of course, you could have two stories that were identical. And one would be, you know, just schlock, and the other would be a beautiful work of art. This telling the story tells nothing. It doesn't tell you what you're going to read. It doesn't tell you what you're going to experience, and it isn't why we read literature. So we have a great machinery out there and a lot of underpaid people who love literature, who are trying to honestly write books, write reviews and books usually too. So it's a tough gig for them, but... It is frustrating when you're 2 years, everything that you've done to hold information back and to have it artfully revealed is then sort of, you know, blown in two columns of newsprint. It's not fun.
I kept thinking, actually, of Grace Paley, who I knew was a friend, a wonderful person, used to talk about a work of art really being a work of truth. And one of the things she said about that was that your job as a writer was kind of getting rid of the lies. And these lies would be the lie of the unnecessary adjective, the lie of writing to your best friend, the lie of writing, you know, for your editor, the lie of the sentence you love the most. There was a little list that I used to sort of hand out to my students as little lies that keep us from being a work of truth. Do you have any of those that you know that you need to scratch out?
Oh, I'm just ticking off the list as you go through. In the sense that, yes, this is what we spend a lot of our time doing, isn't it? Just trying to get rid of everything that you don't need. I don't think I've ever really worried about what the friend would think or the editor would think. It's weird, given how much we all so much want to be loved. But I don't think I have. When you talk about the word the thing that's just not true. I mean, I think one of the things that I spend a lot, because I ask my characters often to do very unreasonable things. And often without really having some sort of intuitive justification, but not anything that would convince anyone in this room. And so I spend a lot of time saying, how would it really be? How would it really, really be? And how would it be? And until in the end, the request or the demand that the character perform an unreasonable act by being interrogated and questioned over and over and over again, finally produces a character which is unlike any character I've ever met, but the character is true to the action. Mm-hmm. And which is really how my characters are made. I don't really tend to sort of draw from life, or even if I started for a second, by the time one's gone through all those demands, the character has to be changed.
Does that mean that you start a character with an action?
Yes. I mean, I think sometimes the books will start even before there's a character. You know, there's something I want to have happen. And the simplest sort of cartoon-like illustration of this is a novel called Oscar and Lucinda, in which I really wanted the book to end with a church on a barge floating along a river. And this was like a cartoon. It was a notion of a box full of Christian stories floating through a landscape, and floating really because I just wanted the box to move smoothly, through a landscape of Aboriginal stories. And from that sort of notion, which is really much a story of my country in all sorts of ways, I built back to saying, who would do such a ridiculous thing? There's no reason to do it. What was this? And so then it becomes a glass church, which may sound more irrational to you, but in fact, in terms of all of this, it becomes more rational and symbolically more alive. And in the end, you've got to find the person who built the glass church and who'd believe what and who did what. And in the end, it goes back to being a love story. And the characters have to perform action. So all of that sounds like a prescription
for something, you know, some very wooden piece of puppetry. But in the end, I know, because enough people have read the book and enough people have been moved by the book for me to know that it doesn't work like that. So in the end, you get these people who you didn't know.
Sometimes I think your chapters are also they're often short and they're conclusively scenes. So maybe what you're doing is also more of a scene than an action. Even as you describe the church, suddenly all of the context comes rushing in. And I'm wondering, do you start with the object? Do you start with the motion of the thing? Or do you start with an actual scene that has a kind of beginning and end that you know you want to get to?
As I'm proceeding through the book, you mean constructing the chapters? Well, I suppose, you know, it sort of gets embarrassing. It all sounds so tacky, doesn't it? But well, you think this has to happen, and then that has to happen, and this person has to think this, and that has to happen. And so I suppose, in particular, I remember thinking at the time of writing Oscar and Lucinda, it was sort of like I was making a series of ceramic tiles almost. And which is one way to think about it, in which each tile of itself had to be perfect in a way, you know, like, but would in as part of the whole also contribute. It's not quite the answer, I guess, but it sort of would indicate how I proceed.
Yeah, I just have one more question. And we're going to open to the audience, actually, but I just wanted to ask you. I notice another through line through your novels is that there are often people moving from one class to another. There's often a kind of messy transition, class transition. In this book, the mother who you guys have been introduced to is from South Boston and went to Harvard and kind of in an interesting place class-wise. And I'm curious, I mean, in almost all your novels, there's something going on with that kind of transition. I'm wondering, does any of that have to do with your own life experience, your class mobility? And then secondarily, has living in America and maybe even writing a book from an American perspective changed at all the way you think about class?
Oh, no.
That's the last one I'm going to get from
you. No, but I suppose it had never... The first part of the question, every now and then it happens that something occurs that has never really quite occurred to one before. And I'm someone that always, for all of the reasons that my earlier answers might suggest, shies away from any notion of autobiographical my life affecting me at all, because that isn't really what I set out to do every day. I tend to have no interest in expressing myself or writing about myself whatsoever. However, it is true that I grew up in a very small Australian town. I was born in 1943. A small Australian town, 30 miles from Melbourne at that time, was so far from art, culture, civilization. The town was basically working class. Kids left school when they were 14. They had their teeth taken out for a quid and went to work and whatever, you know. So they didn't have any more trouble on their teeth. And So I went from that particular environment at the age of 10 or 11 to a boarding school called Geelong Grammar, which was where the Australian elite, the ruling class, sent their kids. It's where, when Prince Charles went to Australia, it's where he went to be a sort of an assistant teacher. When Rupert Murdoch went to school, that's where he went. I could go on. So to go from where I came from into this environment at that age meant, firstly, that I left home at a very, very early age in a very complicated way, remaining very fond of my family, but still in a very complicated way. And even though it took me years to understand where I'd been at Geelong Grammar, I mean, who these people really were, took me a long, long time to understand, but I did sort of understand then. So that's a very deep lesson in class. So, yes.
Okay, good enough. And then the second part of the question being, is it different in America? I mean, in your perspective on class. This book is about class.
I've seen no evidence of class here at all. And the thing that always puzzles me about you guys is that you never seem to have a working class. You only have a middle class. And I don't know how you've managed to do all the things you've done without them, but apparently... so class does seem a very... certainly a strong force in American life, but weirdly labelled and still a puzzle to me, yes.
All right. Well, I have to leave it to you guys now. So is anybody up for it? Over there.
Do you want to encapsulate it? I was just bathing it, and I'm sorry.
He was doing a wonderful job with the kind of magic of Peter Carey's novels and describing some of them, the ins and outs and kind of games and playfulness that go on. But I think also describing the really complicated nature of them. And so he asked how he sort of keeps track of all the various games that are going on within the plot structures and characters.
Well, you know, it all happens a little bit at a time. You know, this is why ultimately writers are such a disappointment, because we like people who've had, you know, 14 goes to be intelligent at a dinner party. We are sort of the Groundhog Day people. You know, we do it again and again and again and again until finally we have elevated ourselves, and so we seem like we're, you know, we did that all at once, which of course we didn't. And there are, for instance, just something of the process. So this won't answer the whole question, but it'll be a bit of it. At the very, very beginning of this book, I thought that I would like to write this from the perspective of the child. And I wanted to do that. I don't know why exactly, but I thought it was something to do with language. He was an American kid. I wasn't even... I have American kids of my own, of course. I thought I could do something with the language that was interesting. And I think now, in my secret, secret heart, I thought, being the foreign father that I am, that if I have a little boy narrator, and if he's wrong, well, he's just a kid, you see. So so I think, you know, we do get into things of trying to protect ourselves from what we can't know and what we fear we don't know, and that we're not ready to go there yet. So I set out then to write the book solely from this boy's point of view. And ultimately, stage about 50 or 100 pages in, whatever it was, I think the thing's very nicely written, but actually it's sort of boring. And I didn't know why it was boring. And one of the curious things, if you talk to writers, you know, or you are a writer, you know, we spend all our time knowing something's not working. And in the end, it's so obvious why it's not working, but we're so dumb at that moment. So finally, I realized that we needed the information from the other point of view, from the woman. So then I then want to introduce her point of view. You know, I teach creative writing, and all my students tell me, you know, that if you can't switch point of view within a chapter, and you can't do this and you can't do that. Well, it's true for them. Yeah. Well, it's a useful rule, but what I wanted to do was switch point of view as the chapter goes along, to go from her point of view to his point of view. There's nothing very difficult about doing it. It's just that, and indeed I would say this in class, you simply need to signpost what you're doing. So if you're going to move from one character's point of view to another, you have to tell the reader, hello, I'm doing this. So that which seems difficult in the end was sort of forced upon me and finally worked, because I had imagined her past and her point of view. So that happens a little bit at a time. And the thing about needing things from the past, well, you don't invent the past all at once. And I tend to bring in the past when I need it. And there it is. But at the same time, I'm very, very proud of the book. And I do think that, you know, one sort of always lives in terror of having nothing else to write and it all drying up and whatever. And I felt that I was writing actually better, that the sentences were better, that they were more pared away, that they were more interestingly nailed together than what I'd done before. So if you enjoyed it, I'm really pleased. Thank you.
Over there. So she's just asking about the title of the book, how did he come to it, and the boy, he's called the boy throughout, just as the mother is called the mother. These are hidden things, and naming is a part of the book.
Titles are so peculiar. You know, I think we all fret too much. We writers fret too much about titles when ultimately it really doesn't give too much of a damn. But when you're writing a book, you somehow think that what you call the book has the magical power to elevate it and to make it into something, really something. And the more trouble you're having, the more you're likely to be sort of thinking of titles for it. And it does cheer you up sometimes. Ideally, it can give you something to drive for or towards, or give you a notion of what you're doing at that moment. But to talk about titles just for a little bit, when I was to talk about Oscar and Lucinda again, I didn't know. I had pages of titles, pages and pages, and none of them were right, and they were all dull or show-off or something. And at the end of when I'd finished it, I talked to my editor, and I said, I don't know what to call this damn thing. And he said, well, I said, really, it's about him and it's about her. And he said, well, call it Oscar and Lucinda. And I said, isn't that boring? He said, no, it's fine. Just relax. So so I did. So the title, and I have a novel called Illywacker, which really is an Australian slang word, which basically, if I could be so vulgar, means sort of bullshit merchant or con man or something like that. And I didn't know what to call this book, but I knew there had to be a word in Australian vernacular that meant, that was at once familiar to us and also vaguely sort of exotic, which meant an illywacker was that word. And I used to look for the word in this dictionary of Australian colloquialisms and slang, like an astronomer might be looking into space for some star that you know has to be there by mathematics, or but you haven't yet seen. And illywacker was, so illywacker was the title. For this one, I sort of, the thing about the title for me is that it really had to represent, I arrived at it very intuitively and very quickly and ridiculously early, and it somehow had to, well, what was satisfying about it when I thought of it was that it represented the child's point of view and the notion of inhabiting the story in the world from his point of view. And the source of the title is rather autobiographical or biographical, because my now 17-year-old son, at a time when we spent a lot of time in Sullivan County, used to be very concerned when he walked out of the trading post, Brad, at North Branch, about illegal drivers. He was a bit scared of illegal drivers. So the notion of, he was just a little boy, he was 5 or 6, and it always seemed sort of sweet to me. He was my son. And so the notion of his illegal self somehow, which is sort of like almost an Irish usage, isn't it? Just sort of came to me, and it seemed to fit, and it seemed to fit the mood of the book.
I think we have time for just one more question. So she's asking about whether or not the aspect of fraudery and trickery that we've talked about a little bit tonight is actually in the nature of an Australian, I think. I'm bending it a little bit.
Stop it.
And secondarily...
And the secondary thing was a gap between the thing of being an artist and actually making art.
Right, which we also talked about a little bit.
Okay, well, let's keep that one for a second. Well, it's very difficult to know how to approach the first part of the question. I keep doing this stuff because I like to do it. And you have to allow in the end for somebody to do something and really, really not really know exactly why they're doing it. It's like being asked, why do you walk the way I walk? You walk. How do I walk? I don't know. You know, I mean, it's, one feels intensely vulnerable at the moment one's asked. But I think it is true that one of the things which I think is implicit in the question is I think we Australians do have an enormous sort of affection for the notion of confidence men and tricksters. And I think that it may well have some sort of thing to do with our colonial history and our relationship with Britain particularly. One of the things I remember about being at my immensely fancy school, so, therefore, hardly being, you know, in the presence of the resentful lumpen proletariat or anything like that, of the enormous joy we all felt when we read that a gang of Australian confidence men had just passed through London and taken everybody for an enormous ride. This is at Geelong Grammar, people felt this. So I think there's something quite deep going on in our relationship with the notion of this sort of trickery. And even if I think of the particular, which I won't bore you with, but the sort of a poetry hoax, which is the basis of one of my books, you can think of it as a trick played on the centre by the periphery. Therefore, to say, you know, you think you're so smart and we're so not smart, well, look at this, we just tricked you. So I think some of those things are at work with us, and that's not a really very full explanation. As for the thing about being an artist and making art, I think the thing of being an artist is some sort of perceived, it's a way somebody would look at somebody through a window who was doing something. It isn't how the person who's making art feels. The person who's trying to make art anyway, which is a better way to talk about it, is just obsessed with, I think, trying to make this slippery, elusive thing just work.
Very, very nice way to end that slippery, elusive thing. Thank you very much.